Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a part of the Agora Podcast Network. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and being more deeply in touch with our own humanity. This is episode 121, and it is an interview with Allison Weir. This is her fourth time on the show, and she is here talking about her new book, Anna of Cleva, The Princess in the Portrait. Before that, though, I just want to make a very exciting announcement. I have received permission from the venue where TudorCon is happening to film and stream the entire weekend. So for those of you who really want to come to TudorCon, but you can't make it to Pennsylvania, I now have a digital ticket available, and you can check that out and learn more at englandcast.com/TudorCon2019. englandcast.com/TudorCon2019 is the link to get you to TudorCon. So you can attend virtually. All the talks will be streamed. It will all be monitored so you can ask questions live. The parties will be streamed with hosts and special interviews just for the streaming attendees. And you even get a swag bag. So check it out, englandcast.com/TudorCon2019. Now let me introduce you to Allison Weir. Allison Weir is the top-selling female historian and fifth best-selling historian overall in the United Kingdom and has sold over 2.7 million books worldwide. She has published 18 history books, including her most recent nonfiction book, Queens of the Conquest, the first in her England's medieval Queen's Quartet. Allison has also published several historical novels, including Innocent Traitor and The Lady Elizabeth. Anna of Cleva, Queen of Secrets, is Allison Weir's ninth published novel and her fourth in the Six Tudor Queens series about the wives of Henry VIII, which was launched in 2016 to great acclaim. The first three books in the series, Catherine of Aragon, The True Queen, Anne Boleyn, A King's Obsession, and Jane Seymour, The Haunted Queen, were all Sunday Times bestsellers. Allison is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and an honorary life patron of historic royal palaces. So Allison Weir, thank you so much for being here on my podcast for a fourth time. I'm just so thrilled to have you.
It's lovely of you to have me back, Heather.
So your new book on Anna of Cleva, I suppose, was that the pronunciation? So you start off right off the bat with an interesting theory about Anna right in chapter one. And I don't want to have to give away too much for people who haven't read it, but it kind of speaks to the idea that we have of her as this kind of innocent person. Can you talk to me about your research with that and kind of what led to that?
Well, it was something Henry VIII said that gave me my storyline, because he kept insisting that Anna wasn't a virgin on their wedding night. Mm. And he didn't just say it once. He kept saying it to anyone who would listen. He said he felt her breasts and her belly, and that by those and other tokens and the looseness of them, she should be no virgin. And I wonder what Henry meant, because everybody thinks, oh, Henry was just trying to wriggle out of the marriage. But that's not grounds. Finding your bride isn't a virgin isn't grounds wriggling out of a marriage. You can't get an annulment on that basis. So I did wonder whether Henry was telling the truth. He'd been married three times. He'd fathered about 15 children. I think he would have known the difference between a female body that had borne children and one that hadn't. Mm-hmm. And that just set me wondering. Of course, that might be doing a huge injustice to Anna, because it set me, because there are other things that could have caused this slackness or perhaps rapid weight loss. A lot of brides lose weight in the run-up to their weddings. And if you're going to leave your country and your family for good, and you're marrying a man like Henry VIII, stress levels must be absolutely astronomical. Mm-hmm. And so she could have lost that weight, you know, through stress. Yeah. We don't know for certain. But there is, I pondered for a long while whether to go with this theory. And because this is fiction, I'd be a lot more cautious writing it as history.
Right.
But even so, there are sources that could be corroborative, sources as to her character. I don't think she was quite the innocent that traditionally she's been thought to be.
Right, and you kind of touched on that in the a couple of places later on, even after she was single, rumors that she was indulging a bit too much in alcoholic beverages and entertaining.
And that she became free with her favors when she did.
Right. And that
comes from her former secretary. And the Imperial Ambassador Chapuis reports this conversation he had with the secretary. And this is about a year and a half after Anna's divorce. But even so, the secretary, it was clear that both of them were aware that this was well known, this information.
Interesting. And then you also kind of hinted that in the very famous conversation that she has with the ladies about he comes in and kisses me goodnight and then he, all of that.
That's a very strange conversation, Heather, because a month later, her chamberlain, who obviously had day-to-day dealings with her, couldn't understand what she was saying. And yet in this account, the ladies' statement, this is all in connection with the annulment, her English is fluent.
Right.
And she could have been speaking through an interpreter. I mean, they were briefed to get her to admit that her marriage hadn't been consummated, because that was going to be one of the grounds for the annulment. So it's a very strange conversation.
I also thought it was interesting. You really show the role of, and I'll just say Cleves because that's what people know it as, but the role of Cleves in the foreign policy kind of world, and that's something that often gets lost when you talk about Anna, in the context of England.
And you need to see her as she saw herself in this European context.
So what can you tell me about her life as a princess in Cleves and how she would have seen herself in this context?
Well, the Duchy of Clever, as it was in Germany, mm-hmm. it was a fief. It was held at the Holy Roman Emperor, but it was pretty independent at the time of Anna's youth. It had its own army, and it had a great culture. A lot of Italian culture came up the Rhine, and there was France not that far away to the west. Mm-hmm. So it was a court based on the new learning of Erasmus. It was an enlightened court because its dukes were Anna's father and her brother. They were technically Catholics, but they were very tolerant, even of Protestants, at a time when Lutheranism is seen as heresy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she grew up at this court. Her mother was a strict Catholic, and she brought her daughters up as strict Catholics. So Anna was always a Catholic. Mm-hmm. But she was brought up, we're told, never far from her mother's elbow. Mm-hmm. And and things like dancing and singing and making music were frowned upon for young girls. Mm-hmm. So it was a very constricted, perhaps suffocating existence for her.
Right. And yet she did, you mentioned Erasmus, and can you tell me a little bit about kind of, it seems almost like a dichotomy that it was this very cultural court, and yet at the same time she wasn't able to take part in any of that.
No, because the women were kept quite apart.
Okay.
So they were more or less isolated. I mean, they were, the girl with the princesses, there were three of them, but one married early. Mm-hmm. They were encouraged to entertain guests at table.
Mm-hmm.
But usually these guests were chosen for them by their parents.
Right, okay. Yeah, and you show an awkward moment where she wants to entertain people and they all kind of, in England, or it was in the scene in Calais, was it?
That's right. Yes, she wanted to do this. She wanted to recreate one of these dinner parties. Of course, English ladies didn't do that, although they had a lot of freedoms in other respects. You know, they had all the sort of accomplishments that Henry VIII admired in women. They could dance, they could sing, you know, they could make music, write poetry. Henry loved all that.
Right.
But Anna didn't have it.
Right. Can you talk to me about her religion, which you touched on, that she was raised a Catholic and that she's often seen, because she was German, as this Protestant bride, but she wasn't really at all, was she?
Well, it's easy to see why this is, people have got this impression, because she was brought up as a strict Catholic, and Henry, I don't think Henry would have married her if she'd been a Protestant.
Mm.
And she observed the Catholic faith, you know, when she came to England. Her father had broken with the Pope. Unlike Henry, he'd stayed friendly with the Pope, mm-hmm. even after the break.
Mm-hmm.
So Henry was sort of felt an affinity with Clever.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know anything about how Anna coped with England turning Protestant under Henry's son, Edward VI. But obviously, when Mary Tudor came to the throne and there was a counter-reformation, then obviously Anna would have been, you know, sort of reverted to, you know, if she'd paid lip service to the Protestant faith in Edward's reign, as a lot of people did, she would have reverted.
Right, okay. And I also want to talk about, obviously, her relationship with Henry and how they became quite good friends afterwards. And it's interesting, because sometimes you see them in the TV shows, like in the Tudors, there's the idea that maybe they were together. And there are those rumors that they actually had a child. And so what can you tell me about their relationship afterwards? They didn't have any children, so
I very much doubt that Henry was the father of any children Anna might have had, because he was too besotted with Catherine Howard at the time. It's inconceivable he would have slept with Anna at the time when, he's very much in love with Catherine Howard.
Yeah.
But the rumours persisted beyond Catherine Howard's execution, and right up towards the end of Henry's reign, there was talk that he would take Anna back.
Mm-hmm.
But some strange transformation had taken place with the divorce, because suddenly they discovered they really liked each other and they became friends.
Mm-hmm.
And this is evident in Henry had made a very generous divorce settlement on Anna.
Yeah.
But the friendship becomes evident, because this is a time of rampant inflation. Prices are doubling in that decade.
Mm-hmm.
Anna's divorce settlement was worth less and less as the years wore on. And Henry supplemented it. He paid for her offices. He paid out expenses when she was ill. And mm-hmm. in one margin of his accounts, he's got payment expenses for, in his own hand, he wrote, "In payment expenses for my beloved sister Anna."
Oh, wow.
So this was a relationship. They became friends,
yeah.
and he looked after her. But it was after his death that things went very wrong for her.
Right, because she didn't have his friendship anymore then.
Well, no, she didn't. And she was just sort of like the spare aunt, you know, the spare stepmother for Edward VI, who clearly didn't have much affection for her.
Right.
And wasn't close to her. And she was just an added drain on royal resources.
Right, sure. So what did she, was it her choice to stay in England afterwards? Because I've also read that it was almost like she was there as a hostage for good behavior, but I don't know how much truth there. Can you talk to me a little bit about that decision?
No, I don't think so at all. The choice was hers. She was frightened of going home because the alliance had collapsed. She thought it didn't collapse, actually, but there was no longer any need for it, because Henry was no longer isolated in Europe. But she thought that the alliance had failed and she would be blamed for it. And she really thought that if she went home, her brother would kill her.
Mm.
But don't forget, I mean, just put yourself in Anna's position. You've had a constricted upbringing. You've not had any freedom. 6 months of a rather miserable marriage, and suddenly you're a rich woman with freedom at your fingertips, great houses to live in, and, you know, would you go home?
No, of course not.
I wouldn't.
No, of course not. Just the idea that she was afraid her brother would kill her. There any kind of what would make her think? Did he have a reputation like that?
Well, no. As it turned out, he was very sympathetic. He was.
Right.
He said all the right things, made all the right diplomatic noises, because he too wanted this alliance to be preserved.
Yeah.
But he needed Henry's friendship.
Mm-hmm.
But privately, he was pretty nasty about Henry VIII. He wasn't very impressed with him at all, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Interesting. And so then, the great mystery of her looks and the painting. You do hint in the book that Holbein went out of favor a little bit after the painting. And I've always heard that as a reason why the painting was a good likeness, because, you know, he wasn't punished afterwards, and that people thought it was a good likeness. What can you tell me in general about the painting?
And, they did. That's true. But I mean, we can't really tell whether it's possible to say that, well, he didn't get so many commissions from Henry after that, but that's not conclusive evidence.
Okay.
But no, there's no record of Henry complaining that Holbein deceived him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as I say, the English envoy in Clever thought that Anna was thought that it was a good likeness.
Yeah.
And I think what was missing with Henry and Anna was the chemistry
right.
that makes a relationship work. Yeah. And also, I think he was dismayed when he saw her. He complained she wasn't as she'd been represented to him. He didn't say that in regard to what she looked like. He was saying it more or less, or had the praise of her that he'd received.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on the wedding night, cinched this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because then he came up with a started coming up with the complaints that, you know, she wasn't a virgin. But the strange thing is that he had. The wedding was delayed for a couple of days because he was trying to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when he couldn't, the wedding went ahead. Mm-hmm. But at the altar, he was asked by Archbishop Cranmer if he knew of any impediments to the marriage. And he said no.
Mm-hmm.
And he also initiated sexual relations on the wedding night, which suggests that he intended to consummate the marriage. And then, I think, he felt Anna's body. He felt these tokens that he thought... suggested she wasn't a virgin.
Mm.
And as he put it himself, I had neither will nor courage to prove further.
Interesting.
And I think he perhaps sort of instinctively saw a way out when it really wasn't.
You also then talk about her her role in Wyatt's rebellion and the role of Mary, her role during Mary's reign. Without giving too much away, I had never heard that about her and, you know, thought about her role in that. So what can you tell me briefly about that?
Well, in the years after her divorce, she came into the orbit of a very unscrupulous man, quite a dangerous man called Sir Thomas Carden. And he was originally her keeper or steward at her big house at Bletchingley in Surrey. And he wanted Bletchingley. I mean, he was keeper of the revels and tents. He was quite a mover and shaker at court.
Mm-hmm.
And he was involved. He was a closet Protestant under Henry VIII. He was involved with Catherine Parr in a secret plot, Protestant plot. He was attached to the Windsor Martyrs who were burned at the stake. He came very near to it. They were actually arrested and freed.
Mm-hmm.
But under Edward, of course, he did very well because he was a Protestant and Protestants were, you know, in high favour.
Mm-hmm.
But under Mary, of course, he was considered a subversive and he sailed very close to the wind. He was involved probably in every single plot against Mary.
Yeah.
And because he was close to Anna, because he was her tenant and they had lots of dealings, she visited him in London, Anna became sort of tainted by association.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe she was guilty at all, but she was supposed to have, with the aid of the future Elizabeth I, who was imprisoned after Wyatt's rebellion,
right.
Because suspected of complicity in it, Anna was accused of having incited her brother to make war,
mm-hmm.
as more or less, as, you know, because Henry had divorced her.
Mm-hmm.
It's nonsense because she'd lived very happily in England for several years.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So your book is just fantastic, like I said. I want to go through here. I had posted in one of my Facebook groups telling people I was going to be talking to you and asking for questions like I normally do.
You.
And I've got a couple questions, some of which we already covered, but I do want to read this one to you that somebody posted. Her name's Aditi, and she said, "This isn't a question, but I would like to thank her. I recently finished Isabella, Queen of England, She-Wolf of France, and it was just amazing. I liked the way she differentiated facts and built up myths about the Queen. I also appreciate the amount of research she did. As a 17-year-old moving to college in a totally different country, I am taking the books authored by her with me as moral support." So I thought you might enjoy hearing that.
That's so nice. That's lovely to read something like that.
Isn't it really nice?
If you see her, please thank her.
I'm going to write a comment here and tell her to listen to the podcast because I read it to you.
Yes, please do. That's lovely. Thank you.
So somebody asks here, how long do you spend in research on your historical fiction? And also, what's the coolest, most interesting thing you've discovered about any of the people you've written about? That's quite a big question.
Well, I spent years, you could say, because, I mean, the novels, the fiction I'm writing now is based on research I did over a long period of time, mostly for non-fiction books. Some of it's unpublished as well. Mm-hmm. And an awful lot. Yeah. And then, what was the other question?
What's the coolest, most interesting thing you've discovered about any of the people?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was discovering various things about Anne Boleyn's execution, I think. I was finishing researching a book called The Lady in the Tower, which is non-fiction, about Anne Boleyn's fall. Mm. And literally in a month before I was delivering the book, I found just one thing after another. The different new evidence came up about Anne's execution and her burial, and it was really exciting.
Interesting. That book stayed with me, and The Lady in the Tower, and your graphic descriptions of her beheading.
Oh,
and
God. It was grueling. Sorry, my editor said he needed a stiff drink after reading it.
You know, I woke up with nightmares to it because I finished it before I went to bed, and I was like, oh, that's awful.
Oh, sorry. But
no, it's okay. It's fine. It was very gripping. So,
thank you. It's all based on truth, and there were these sources that people quoted from. Everybody quoted from these particular sources, but they didn't quote from the whole source. Yeah. And so there was swathes of material that had never been used or looked at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody here, Susan, says, do we know anything about what her family felt about the divorce? And also, did she remain in contact with her family in the following years? Will you answer that in the book
a lot? She did remain in contact with her family, yes. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, her brother made all the right diplomatic noises, but he privately was quite scathing about Henry.
Mm-hmm.
And in later years, when things did get bad in England, because Anna was very poor, this is after Henry's death, mm-hmm. you know, the poverty kicked in. Anna's brother sent ambassadors to help her out, you know, and mm-hmm. made representations to the English government, you know, generally was very supportive.
So there are a couple of people here asking about her relationships after the divorce, if she could have remarried, and there's a couple here, did she have anyone later in life romantically?
Not outside the novel, no. But
right.
But you've got to remember that for some 6 years after she married, there were rumours that Henry might take her back.
Right.
They kept resurfacing, even though I don't believe there was any foundation to them. But while those rumours were current, was any man likely to come forward to suggest marriage to her?
Right. And you also talked in the book about the way the annulment or the divorce was written, that it seemed as if he was more at liberty to marry, that because the pre-contract, then that was part of the reason for the divorce, which meant that the pre-contract still existed for her then, in theory.
But it's very strange, because of the contradiction in the actual documentation of the divorce. When the bishops pronounced, when Convocation dissolved the marriage and Parliament later confirmed it, it was said that both parties were free to remarry.
Yeah.
There were three grounds for the annulment. One was non-consummation, which Henry played down.
Right.
And the other was, the main one was this pre-contract that hadn't been formally dissolved.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was that King had not consented to the marriage.
Okay.
But you've got to. So I've lost my train of thought now completely. Sorry.
That's okay. We were talking about if she could remarry and the pre-contract.
Yes, that's right.
That,
yes. Yeah. So they said that they're saying on one hand she's still married to the son of the Duke of Lorraine.
Right.
And on the other hand, she's free to remarry. It doesn't make sense.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Technically, she was. I mean, the Duke of Lorraine's son, who became Duke of Lorraine, had actually married.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point was that they were both Anna and the Duke of Lorraine's son. When they were pre-contracted, they were children. They were under the age of consent, which was 12 for girls and 14 for boys.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it had been assumed by their fathers that when this alliance was broken, they didn't have formally to dissolve the betrothal, have it broken properly.
Mm-hmm.
But and Henry was rather concerned. You can understand Henry's concern, because if at any time someone turned around and says she's married to someone else,
right?
That could compromise the English succession.
Right, right, of course. And his track record wasn't that great, so he needed to make sure it was right on.
Well, absolutely, yes. I mean, he looked a fool, but it was also like a question of, you know, secure. I mean, if she bore him a child, for example, and mm-hmm. the future Edward VI had died, her child would have been first in line to the throne.
Right.
And then if somebody comes along and says, oh, she wasn't properly married to the king because she was pre-contracted to somebody else, mm-hmm. That could bastardize her child.
Exactly.
Looking at the question of remarriage, there is this to it, but also the fact that the king is circling and nobody's likely to sort of, you know, trespass where the king might go.
Sure. Here's one that says, did Anne know about Henry's interest in Catherine Howard right from the beginning, or how did she discover it? And you show that in the book as well, so people should read the book. But
fictionalize that, because we just don't know. I think she did know. I think later on, I don't think it took a little while.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Looking forward to reading this book when it's available. That's nice. And somebody said here, where was the comment? They were at a talk by you at the Real Wolf Hall about 6 months ago, and you mentioned you were going to be publishing a revised version of the Six Wives of Henry VIII book. I'd love to know when that will be coming out. Really keen to read her new research.
Nobody knows, because I've researched and rewritten all five of the wives now.
Right.
And it's been greatly expanded. And I do know that my UK publishers, non-fiction publishers, have suggested republishing it as a series of six biographies. Now, whether that will happen, I don't know, and when it will happen. But it can't happen to compete with the current books, if you see what I mean, this novel series. So it's something for the future.
Right.
And I need to do more work on it, because I've got these revised biographies, but I still want to go on researching. Sure. So these novels are sort of interim project to use the research that I've done already in the new theories.
Right. Interesting. Fascinating. Somebody says here, how does she get in the mindset of these characters? She's so good at it. I feel like I'm in the room with them when reading their words, even though I know they've been fictionalized.
Oh, my goodness. That's lovely. Nice to get that kind of feedback. It's just, I think I've lived with them for so long. Mm-hmm. And you know, you do a lot of background research on them. You look up, you find out about the character, you know, the characters in the book as much as you can, and try to imagine how they would feel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're writing each of these books has been written solely from each queen's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to sort of get inside her head.
Yeah. Do you ever struggle with the shifting when you go from one to the other, like when you would go from having been in Catherine of Aragon's head to getting into Anne Boleyn's?
No, because, I mean, Anne Boleyn was the biggest challenge, and I discussed that with my editors, because I was a bit concerned, because I don't, as a historian, I take a bit of a dim view of Anne Boleyn, because the evidence shows, I think, you know, she's important, pardon me, historically, but she doesn't seem to have been a particularly nice person. I can't understand why she's so a heroine for so many people, because there are so many issues around her, and the whole mythology is built up around her too.
Sure.
I went back to original sources and, you know, found out some quite really interesting things about her.
Mm-hmm.
But I was worried that I was going to write a book that wasn't sympathetic to the heroine. And my editor said, think about what her motives were, how she got from A to B, basically. Think of everything from her point of view. And that's what I should have done, mm-hmm. what I did do. And it was easier.
Yeah.
And my agent, when I delivered the book, he said, you've written a really sympathetic biography or novel.
Yeah, that's high praise.
I think a lot of people don't like my views on Anne Boleyn, because she's almost a superstar.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's that whole kind of modern cult around her being almost like a feminist, when it's hard to put a modern construct on
that view by default. Because when I was researching Anne Boleyn, I was talking to the historian Sarah Griswold, who was doing a book called Game of Queens about the women who ruled.
She's been on my show as well. Yes.
And I said to her, I said, people just, I was complaining. I said, people you know, see Anne Boleyn as a feminist icon, but, you know, I don't get that at all. And she said, well, actually, she said, you can see why she was. And Anne Boleyn was at the courts of Margaret of Austria and the future Queen of Navarre. Mm-hmm. And they were eager participants in this feminist debate that was actually going on in Europe at that time, but not in England.
Right.
It was the Cradle des Femmes, and it was questioning, you know, right. It was saying that women should be more equal with men. You know, they should have more autonomy and more power. And Anne was exposed to this very early on, and it must have been part of what shaped her.
Sure, sure. Back to Anne, Anna here. I have, let's see, there's just a couple more questions I want to go through here quickly because I know we're running out of time. This is, I almost don't want to mention it, but I feel like if I don't, it'll be a disservice because some other people might be thinking it too. It's been inferred that she was a lesbian. Is this true? I'm not sure I've ever heard that one, and she was also strict Catholic. So
inferred it. Oh, goodness, I've never heard this.
Okay, so we'll just say no to that. And then someone here says they were at a book signing of yours in Chorleywood, and you were lovely, and they loved meeting you. So there's that going as well. If I missed anybody's questions here, I'm so sorry. There's a lot of questions about her looks and her appearance, which we kind of talked about. So I think I caught them all here, and if I didn't, I apologize, and you have to read the book and you'll get answers to everything in the books.
No problem.
Perfect. So thank you.
You covered an awful lot.
Well, we try to get a lot in here, right?
You do.
Thank you so much for your generosity with your time. I know for so many of us, myself included, you were our entree into this Tudor world, and it's just such a joy to always speak with you and to have you share your time.
Thank you so much, Heather. You are very, very kind.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Alison Weir for being here on the show. I can't wait until next year to talk to her about her book on Catherine Howard. In the meantime, go buy the Anna of Cleva book. It's amazing. It's such a good book. You will really enjoy it. I promise. You can get show notes with links and all of the links to buy the book, everything like that, at englandcast.com. And also remember to go to englandcast.com/TudorCon2019 to check out your TudorCon digital ticket. I cannot wait to see you either in person or virtually at TudorCon this year. It's going to be so much fun. All right, I'll be back in about 2 weeks. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Blow, northern wind, send for me sweating. Blow.